Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. It is Beyond the Darkness, and I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Guys, we got something really cool coming up for you a little bit later on in the show. You know, on Fridays, we feature Theater of the Mind. Well, this week, if you are a follower on our app, Darkness Radio on the Google Play Store, you're probably already familiar with one of the shows that we feature in our app, which is New England Legends under the Legends tab. And this week, we're going to share an older episode. It's about a 10 to 11 minute story episode from New England Legends, because you're always asking us what's a great show to listen to, what's a great piece. And once a week, they come out with these every Thursday. And they're anywhere from 6 minutes to 15 minutes long, and they go over some of the coolest history and stories. And in this episode, Jeff Belanger and Ray Auger explore the woods around Camp Karana in Cumberland, Rhode Island, in search of Fingernail Freddy and Hotshot Charlie, two reclusive men monsters who are said to stalk the children of the summer camp should they try to get out of line. Is there a connection between these legends and the Nightmare on Elm Street movie franchise? You'll have to stay tuned for the show to hear that. But coming up first, we've got something really cool happening for you. Now, you guys know I've been a part of the Dark Zone, which is a really great new paranormal society. We're bringing together different paranormal minds and investigators and TV personalities from all around the world into one place, the Dark Zone. And you can find us if you just check out on Facebook.com. I'll include a link to that so you can find us there. And we've got original programming appearing on Footprint.tv. And as part of our umbrella of the Dark Zone, we've just launched a brand new program called Encounters. It just began airing on March 19th, and it's great. Great show, really cool opportunity for you guys to check out something, and a program based in the UK. Joining us this evening on the show is that contributor, Jason Higgs. He's out there, he's got the great show kicking off, and he's been interested in the paranormal since a very young age. As a matter of fact, when he was around 9 years old, he had his first spooky encounter. At 15, he joined the British UFO Research Association, and his search for the supernatural took hold when he joined a Cornwall paranormal group. And in 2007, he co-founded Supernatural Investigations UK with 5 other members. He's here to talk to us about his own experiences, some of the most amazing haunted locations he's had a chance to visit. And we'll hear about Encounters and what sets us apart from other programming. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Dave. How are you, mate?
I'm doing great. Thanks. I know it's very early for you, late for us. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate this.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it's just after 5:50 here, so it's a bit early, still dark, and the birds haven't started singing yet.
Excellent. Well, you know, it's still that dark, creepy hour, right? That going into sleep and coming out of sleep time. So this is a perfect time for us to get together. Now, you were very young when you had your first encounter. What type of encounter was that?
Yeah, I think I said about 9, but I'm thinking back now, and I think it was slightly earlier. But basically, my parents, we moved down from a place called Birmingham in the UK, down to a place called Cornwall, and a little village called St. Clair. And we moved into this house, nice house, and we'd been there a number, well, probably only about a year, I would say. And this one evening, gone to bed as usual, had my own bedroom. My parents had gone to bed as well, and it was dark. I'd fallen asleep. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night, absolutely parched, really, really requiring a drink of water or something. And as I woke up, I realized I was in some sort of panic. And I called out to my mum and I said, "Mum, mum, I need a glass of water. I need a glass of water." And in she came. It must have been probably 3 o'clock in the morning. And she said, "Okay, okay, I'll go and get you a glass of water." And then proceeded to calmly walk down the stairs to the kitchen. And as I'm lying there, I look up, and at the end of my bed, I see this dark shadow figure looking out of my bedroom window. And I thought, Mum, it's got to be my mum. There's no one else who'll be stood in my bedroom. And I said, Mum, look, can I have a glass of water, please? And with that, I turned round to the right and I watched my mum ascending the staircase with a glass of water to bring back to me. And I looked back towards the end of the bed and the dark shadow figure was gone. And my mum brought me the water. I drank the water, and being probably, I think I was about 7 or 8, I looked and I thought, well, okay, maybe I dreamt that, you know, maybe there's nothing else in this. So I drank the glass of water and fell back asleep. But really, that was probably the first knowing nor known event that I experienced of many while we're in that house, and various other dreams or nightmares, if you want to call them that, following that event, you know, over sort of the years that we lived there, was, you know, waking up screaming, imagining the wallpapers are being ripped off the wall, trying to get out of the bedroom, but the door being locked. I believe they were all dreams and nightmares thinking back now, but at the time they seemed very real.
Well, talk to me about this moment, right? When you think you see your mom come into your room, you ask her for water, she says she'll go get it, and then when you turn and look, something is standing in your room at the end of your bed, looking out towards the window. This dark shadow form. Now, in your mind, even though you just saw mom take off to go get you water, your mind kind of does a hiccup move, right? You're trying to rationalize what you're seeing. And, well, it must be my mom. I must have just imagined seeing her go down the stairs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of that age as well. And if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you've just woken up. You're in the daze anyway. My mind had obviously made the rational decision to tell me, oh, that's your mum. You know, that dark shadow figure, which actually looks nothing like your mum, is your mum.
Was there any movement from this figure, or did it just stand there silently staring?
There was slight movement from sort of side to side. So that's what made me realize it wasn't just a shadow of something in the room. You know, this room was fairly empty. It was just my bed. There was no ornaments or tall standing objects that could have cast this shadow. And my room was in total darkness. But the dark shadow just happened to be darker than the rest of the room. And also because my curtains were shut, but it must have been quite a light evening because the light was being cast into the room. And this dark shadow was stood in front of it. So it was poignant at the end of the bed. But it definitely, there was something about it that obviously has stayed with my memory all this time. And I spoke to my mum about it, and she remembers the event because she wondered why I'd questioned why she was stood at the end of my bed.
When you look back, okay, you're looking at this shadow figure. And I know this is throwing you back a few years. And then you look and you see mom coming up the stairs with a glass of water. Is there any sense of panic or anxiety that starts to rise in you for realizing you just saw somebody standing in your room and you thought it was your mom, but now here is your mom?
There wasn't, which surprised me because it was almost as though my mind had made the rational decision that mom wasn't walking down the stairs. She was at the end of the bed, so therefore don't panic. But then when I saw mom coming back up the stairs with the glass, it was almost as though my mind had then made that decision to say there was nothing there, so don't worry about it. You know, your mum's here now. Mm. And I think being at such a young age, there's two things. And I think it's being at such a young age, you don't have the same fear or understanding as when you get older and you get more educated. And I think the second thing is that being a child, you are open to these type of experiences more. Again, because you're not educated and you haven't passed through the filtering of your mind process as you get older. And I remember, but obviously it must have imprinted something on my mind because I remember the event as clear as day, and I always have.
Now, looking back at that again, okay, so now you're reflecting back on what that was and what you saw, and you can see how the rationale of the moment you tried to dismiss this as something, you know, scary or unusual. Like you said, it was mom. Wait, no, there's mom. Oh, I must not have really seen that. Was it troublesome to go back to sleep? Or do you find that even after your drink, did you fall back asleep pretty quickly?
I fell back asleep pretty quickly, if I remember rightly. And then I questioned my mum again about it the next day. And I think she palmed off some sort of, you know, it's just your a relative that's probably come back and is protecting you, you know, that kind of story, and saying, you know, they're just looking over you, looking after you, basically. It's like a guardian angel that's just checking on you, making sure you're okay, which obviously then as a child fills you with, you know, sort of ease and comfort. But sort of since then, I've always asked a lot of other people, done a bit of research into this, and I'm absolutely surprised at the amount of people who said that when they were a child, they also saw shadow figures standing at the end of their bed or near where they sleep.
Well, Jason, the reason I ask about that so much is, you know, I actually believe your mom was onto something. And the reason I say that, I've interviewed on the radio and in person and at events and organizations around the world, and have asked people about shadow people encounters. And when I ask a room of, you know, 200, 500, 1,000 people, how many people have witnessed a shadow person? And, you know, a big chunk of people in the room will raise their hands. And then I'll say, now, how many of you can honestly say you were afraid?
Yeah.
Very few keep their hand up. And I say, how many of you, once you got over that kind of shock and awe of seeing it, just, you know, you kind of dismissed it and maybe even just rolled over and went back to sleep. And most of those hands still stay up. And
yeah,
that led me to think, if there was something inherently dangerous, that would set off our fight or flight response, right? And we should be triggered. So I wonder, I mean, if we really do leave our bodies, our souls, you know, go on a little journey at night, whether it's astral projection or whatever you want to refer to it as, if these souls have left the body, that would be the time that we are most vulnerable. So to me, it makes sense that there would be guardians or relatives or angels, whatever you want to refer to them as, that might stand sentinel over us to make sure that we're okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good theory. I like that. Because, and as you say, the comforting part of it, you know, where you wake up, you see it, and you're okay with it. It's like you've right. already got an intrinsic relationship with that figure.
Right, because if you, I mean, and I've asked people this, I said, now you imagine that moment when you saw that shadow person, or in some cases, multiple shadow people standing in the room, and people kind of get that start, and then they go, oh, huh, and then they kind of roll over and go back to sleep. I said, now I want you to imagine tonight you wake up, and I'm standing at the end of your bed in the dark room staring at you. Would you just look at me and go, huh, darkness Dave, and then just roll over and go to sleep? And everybody starts laughing, or they shake their heads and say, no. I said, exactly. Why is that? Why? You know, there has to be something. I mean, even if you saw, oh, it's just darkness Dave, you would still have that, what the hell is he doing in my room, right? We would all have that initial, hey, this doesn't feel right. This isn't good at all. And that's why I've started to believe that there might be something more to it. Now, the reason I really wanted to push this with you is, I know at the age of 15, you end up joining the British UFO Research Association.
That's correct, yeah.
I'm curious, you know, I've talked about this, and then I get kind of a deluge of email from listeners around the world that say, I think the reason I felt this kind of muted sense was because I was in the presence of an alien being, and they put me back under. And they have kind of dampened that sense fear, that anxiety. Doing the research you've done and the interviews that you've done over the years, do you give any credence or lend any credibility to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a well-known sort of correlation, isn't it, between people seeing figures in their room and then that whole feeling and the experience of you know, sort of alien or UFO technology. And that's certainly probably the mindset I started off in, because even though I had these nightmares following it, and there was a lot more sort of paranormal experiences that sort of followed that, my first jump into the research in this industry was with Bufora. And it was, again, actually, ironically, after my own experiences with something I can't explain, that I thought, I need to get into this and find out what's going on here. And the whole experience was when I was about, it was probably when I was about 14 years of age. So literally probably about 6 months before I joined Bufora, a girlfriend that I was seeing lived in a neighboring village. This is when I moved to Wales, obviously just outside of England in the UK. And, I was visiting my girlfriend in a little place called Bather. And there's a back road that leads all the way back to where we lived, which was in Church Village. And it's probably about 3 miles in distance, but being sort of young and fit, I used to run it every day and every night. So I'd run down into Bather, see my girlfriend, and then late at night I'd run home again. And it was just running home one evening. It was a nice clear evening. Stars were out. And I was running down this lane. And all of a sudden I saw this glowing metallic object in the sky to my left. And I thought, that's a bit strange. What's this? You know, it doesn't look like a plane. And this object dropped to almost my head height. And it was probably no more than 10 meters to the right of me. Probably about 30 feet to the right of me over this field. And it was just hovering there. And then it shot off in my direction forwards, the same direction I was traveling back home, at super speed. I'd never seen anything go so quick. And a car came flying past me on the same road. Well, as the car sort of looked like it was chasing after this object, I then started sprinting to chase after the car to try and catch up with whatever it was. And as we're running along, I noticed that the object had dropped into a neighboring field. And this car that was probably now a fair distance in front of me pulled into that neighboring field. And as I got to the field, I watched this object shoot up at super speeds and just disappear into the sky. And I, when I got there, I spoke to the occupants of the car. There was three people in the car. And I said, what on earth was that? And they just turned around and said, we have no idea. We don't know. And they were all pale. They were sort of panicking. And they'd all seen it. All three occupants of the car had seen this metallic object floating probably about 6 feet off the ground and then literally zoomed up into the sky. And with that, I sort of, you know, they disappeared and I ran off back home, fell asleep, thought nothing more of it. And then the next day, there was an article in the newspaper and loads of people, thousands of people in the village that my girlfriend lived in Bather, had seen the same object and it made the papers. And that just, and I thought, no way, I can't believe it. I literally just had a near experience with something we can't explain, you know, a UFO.
In the newspaper accounts, did they try to get to the bottom of what this was? Was there an official release from your government or news agencies? Oh, this was, you know, a weather balloon. This was, you know, a kite, you know, something that they could try to dismiss.
No, unfortunately. I mean, the article basically, you know, wrote about, you know, what people had seen. It was more about witness statements. You know, all these people have seen this metallic object, and most of it was filled with interviews of people. Oh, what did you see? And it was all the same sort of description, the same object. But I think it was the fact that there was a seemingly lack of investigation following up from this that I thought, right, I need to get into this and start researching it properly and finding out what's really going on here.
Now, are you starting to correlate the fact that you've had paranormal experiences, you've now seen a UFO, are you starting to question at all in your mind, I wonder if everything that I'm experiencing is alien in nature as opposed to ghostly or, you know, wraith-like creatures?
I mean, that's a good question. I hadn't. In my mind, there was a clear division between the two. So there was seemingly otherworldly experiences from, you know, visitations from UFOs potentially. And then also potentially netherworldly regions, you know, wherever ghosts and spirits exist and can break through into our world and communicate potentially. I mean, from the paranormal side of things, at this point, I hadn't really communicated or had the opportunity to experience interaction with the paranormal. It was more about signs and things that were going on around the house. And there was lots of them, you know, sort of in wherever we seemed to move to was the same sort of thing. And it kind of followed up on the guardian angel principle with regards to an old gent that was living in our house before we moved in. And we never knew anything about this guy. And he apparently, he was still there basically. And what we didn't realize is that he had died in the property. We didn't realize this until after I did a bit of research, same time that I was in before, to find out what was going on. But the funny thing with this experience was that I'd be in the kitchen and I'd be peeling spuds and I'd feel a hand touch me on the shoulder. And then it'd be like, turn around, and then there was no one there. And it happened on a number of occasions. And I used to, again, say to my mum, you know, what's going on here, you know? And she would just dismiss it out of hand, saying, oh, your muscles twitching, or you're having cramp in your shoulder or something along those lines. But then one day I remember going upstairs, and she had friends around, my mum, and I would sit on the stair and I'd listen to what they were talking about. And this one time my mum had actually turned around and said, yeah, Jason's experiencing the same thing. And I thought, I can't believe it. My mum has, and she's a strong Christian, my mum, and she'd also had experienced or had seen or had felt the presence of this gentleman in our house. Now, the weird thing is we had a cat and a dog at the time. And as you probably know, Dave, you know, animals are very susceptible to this thing. And you'd be sitting in the lounge and watching TV, and the cat and the dog would be over by the door, and then they'd both look up at the kitchen door at the same time, and they're both eyes would track across the room to, you know, the bedroom doors or the lounge door to go upstairs, and then they'd both put their heads down. So I always wondered, what on earth are they looking at? But the real verification for me was, I had a friend in school, and he was his mum was a vicar, and he was a very tough character. And he wouldn't take any sort of rubbish from anyone. You know, he had a hard character, but underneath I knew he was a softie. But he always portrayed this, you know, don't mess with me, nothing's wrong, all this type of thing. And he came down one day because I was staying at his house. My mum had been in hospital. And we'd gone down to my house to sort of feed the animals, make sure they're okay. He came down with me, sat on the sofa. I'd gone upstairs to get something. And this is probably 2 years, 3 years after my initial experience. And when I come back downstairs, he was as white as a sheet. And I said to him, I said, are you okay? He goes, yeah. Are we going now? And I said, yeah, sure. I'll just put the animals to bed and then, yeah, we'll go. So I locked up, off we went back to his house, and he was quiet for the rest of the evening. And I remember saying to him, I said, what's going on? I said, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. And I thought, there's something not right here. Anyway, after much more prodding, he eventually came out and said, I can't believe what I've seen. And I said, what have you seen? And he said, I watched basically it was an old gent, walk through our kitchen door, which was shut, across our lounge and out through the front door, which was also shut. And he said it was like a real human being, slightly paler, in color, and it walked through the physical objects of the kitchen door and the front door. And I smiled because it just verified to me what I'd experienced. But it also annoyed me because in the entire time that I'd lived in the house, I'd never seen it. And here my friend had been in the house for a matter of minutes and had witnessed it firsthand. And for me, it was great verification because it just, you know, backed up everything that I'd been experiencing and everything that I'd felt. And it that really, at that point, my interest in the paranormal really peaked. And so sort of the two went together, you know, interviewing and witnessing UFO activity as well as paranormal activity.
Why do you think it is, in your personal mindset, that Jason can sense it, feel it, hear it, but can't see it? But yet your friend comes over and he can see it. What is the difference between one person to another on how they perceive these hauntings? Do you think he just happened to be in the right place at the right time and saw the manifestation? Or do you think that, much like when you were a child, you had convinced yourself there was nothing there, so you just don't see because you're kind of shut off to the visual aspect of the paranormal?
I think that's probably it, Dave. From the years of studying that's gone on since that time, with supernatural investigations and certainly on encounters, as we do a lot of witness reports and things with different people and their experiences. We've been called into private houses with regards to other people's experiences. And I do believe that as a child, before you've been fully educated in lots of different things, you're very open, you're very sort of susceptible to any experiences. And I believe as a child, you have a wider visual spectrum, you have a wider audio spectrum, and I believe you're more sensitive to touch and to feelings and to smells. And I mean, this is evident in the fact that every child can sort of speak any language, and not just speak the language, but also perform the sort of the accents that the language should sound like. But you get to a certain age and your mind says, well, I'm not going to need that skill set now because I'm living in this country. I'm not going to need to be able to speak French, or I'm not going to be able to speak Italian. And also, if they learn the language, you know, they can speak it in their tongue, native tongue, as opposed to trying to put an Italian slant on it. And it loses that skill set, and they say you never really actually get that back. And I think the same thing happens as you grow older as a child, as you dismiss experiences, because probably majority of the times your parents are going to say, no, that's rubbish, you haven't got an imaginary friend, you know, that didn't happen. I think you shut yourself off to those possibilities. And I think you're right. I think in some ways people are more susceptible if they've had a more open upbringing than other people who may have been shut down at an earlier age. Because I get lots of people, you know, and they say, no, I don't believe, and I've never seen anything, I've never experienced anything. And I just think, well, I think more people are more susceptible to it than other people. I think there's some ways that you ignore certain stuff, whereas someone else would probably see it. You know, you could walk [S2] Right. [S1] Down the street and find a £10 note on the floor after someone has walked over it. You know, that what they've got blinkered views towards the direction they're going in. They only see what interests them, whereas someone else will walk down the street and see something totally different, you know, and see that £10 note.
I wonder, Jason, if we set an intention, we talk a lot about intention in the world of paranormal investigating, whether it's using things like a Ouija board or an audio recorder or photography, you set the intention for good things to come through or to have an experience. And your mom pretty much spent most of your childhood and early teenhood telling you, oh, you're just imagining things. You know, it's a twitch in your shoulder. It's nothing more than that. It's a breeze through the window. So you were basically being retrained in how you experience this. So to you, it wouldn't exist. So you would not see a visual aspect of this. But your friend coming in and having no expectations, not knowing the story, he wouldn't have been as keen to have been tuned out. So maybe that's why he saw what you had never actually seen. So I wonder,
absolutely.
I wonder if you set your intention going in, which is now we run into a really sticky wicket with this, as I'm sure you can attest, because we want the cleanest experience we can get, the most natural, without trying to overhype ourselves. Right, and generate it. But if we go into the intention of tonight, I will see, you know, tonight I will have an experience and I will do this, and it will be a profound vision. You know, I wonder if we could do that without making it a self-hypnotic suggestion, but instead setting the intent so that we're recalibrating so that the eyes can see what's there around us. I wonder if that's possible, or what kind of effect that would have on the mind that could be easily dismissed as, well, you and I both know a lot of people they want to have a paranormal experience. So sometimes even the most subtle of natural things are going to take place, and they're going to swear up and down to you that it is paranormal. Even though you can give them 100 logical explanations and recreate it for them, it's paranormal and there's no getting around it. So, you know, I mean, there's a problem to a degree I see in setting the intention and then having to question yourself, did I really experience this, or did I set myself up to believe that I'm experiencing this? That's the weird part about this field, right? There's no definable way to go in and make yourself ready to have an experience without being worried that it may influence how you perceive something that maybe normally you would have dismissed as a natural element.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because it's all about suggestibility. And sort of part of the research side of things with regards to this is the repeated measures. You know, it's the whole, how do you perform the experiments that we need to use to try and either prove or dismiss or, you know, look at this field. And the problem is with most experiments that you perform, it's in a controlled environment with controlled sample. And then you only ever manipulate one variable at a time to then see if there's a correlation. And unfortunately, in this game, that's almost impossible to do because every environment is different. There are so many different variables at play. And I'm not even just talking about whether tech works, but even down to, as you say, personal experiences, because we have the ability to auto-suggest and psychologically experience stuff that actually isn't there.
You know what, where that could be definable, and I know it'd be hard for you in the encounter setting because you do these things alone when you do the investigation. But if you did it on your own and then had a visual experience, we would question, did you set yourself up for that? But wouldn't it be interesting if you worked with a team that you all sat there and set the expectation together prior to the investigation that we will see, we will experience, we will do this, and made it a very set deal? Because if all of you set that intention and have the similar experience and see something together, then you have to dismiss that it was a one-off hypnotic suggestion. That it's your own deal, because then you're kind of recalibrating the experiment for a wider audience.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. And ironically, that's usually the setting that we have when we do investigations as a team. So that's the one thing with regards to encounters that we miss is the personal verification of not having a second or third party there to obviously back up, you know, multiple seeings or multiple experiences, which you can then say, wow, we all experienced that. It can't just be me. Certainly that is an issue with encounters. But the pro of that is, well, we're taking away any other contaminated experiences. So right. No one else's stomach is making a sound. No one else is walking into a wall. No one else is hitting the floorboard. And certainly not faking anything as well, that if we do capture anything that we can then present to the public, you know, via audio or via video, then that's even the better experience, I think, in certainly for all presenting to the viewer. I could sit there all day and say things that I'm experiencing, but I think what the viewer wants is to see something or hear something. And I think certainly with filming encounters, thankfully we have managed to do that, which is brilliant, really, because, as you know, in this game, it's you could spend 6 months. It's like, I always say to the people who come on investigations with us, it's like fishing. You could go down to the river, you could sit there for hours on end and not catch anything. Or you could go down and get a plethora of fish for your catch. And I've been on investigated. I went through a period a couple of years ago where 6 months of investigating in probably 8, 9, 10 different locations and didn't have a single experience, didn't capture a single thing on voice recorder or on video, and had no experience with any of the tech that we had. And I really started to question everything that had gone before. You know, it got to the point where I'm thinking, have I just made all this up? Have I just experienced probably natural experiences and put them as paranormal? And I really started to question everything. And then we went to this one location and it just made it. There was a team of us at this private location near where I live. And we'd all experienced the same thing. And I think we actually captured something on audio, and then it just brought it all home for me again. And it was like, yeah,
well,
this is why I do
Jesus,
this.
Jason, where did you go and what was the experience that you had together?
The experience, basically, I'm just trying to think where it was now. I think it was, I can't say where it was because it was a private location and the owner would not like it being made public.
Fair enough.
But it was a big, big manor house. And it was just the committee team, if you like, of Supernatural Investigations, because the group itself became a member group. So we took on members of the public who then wanted to be trained up and learn how to do investigations and sort of set up equipment and review equipment. But for this evening, it was just a committee group. So there was about 12 of us in the room in this building. And I'm just trying to think what we caught on audio, but basically personal experience we all had was we were in the one room and we're all calling out and we asked for some feedback. And basically, the wall, we said, oh, can you knock on the wall? If you're here, can you knock once for yes, two for no? And there was a clear bang on the wall that said, yes, I'm here.
Now, wait a minute. And then Did you just ask him to knock twice if he wasn't there?
Yeah.
Knock once if you're here, twice if you're not. Yeah, I'm sure. See if you've got a prankster ghost in your hand.
Exactly, yeah.
Funny.
We honestly do that just for the verification side of things. But as you say, just to make sure no one else is messing around, but also you could have a joke ghost. You know, they might be having a bit of fun with you.
Well, that's why you're supposed to say knock once on the wall if you're here, twice if you're not, and three times on the ceiling if you want me.
Yeah, that sounds like a good song.
Exactly. Encounters is a brand new paranormal show, and it uses the latest cutting-edge technology in the paranormal field and sees seasoned investigator and Haunted Plymouth team member Jason Higgs experienced alleged haunted locations around the country alone. And although he investigates overnight alone, the Encounters project team is made up with Kevin Hines, who's a psychic medium. Is it Mikey Parkinson?
Mikey Parkinson, yes.
Well, he's an investigator and producer. You've got Rich Silverwood, who is an investigator and producer, and James Fletcher, who's a producer. We're going to take a break, and we'll continue our talk and our encounters with Jason Higgs as the show continues. What are some of the more unusual and frightening locations and experiences that he has had? We'll also talk about a couple of his books that he's got out there and some of the stories he's collected for that. But first, let me reintroduce you. This is really great. A good friend of our show for many years, Jeff Belanger. He is the lead writer and researcher for the hit TV show Ghost Adventures. He has a podcast that's on every Thursday. It's called New England Legends, and you can check it out for yourself, OurNewEnglandLegends.com. That's OurNewEnglandLegends.com. You can subscribe. It's free. It's fun. It's anywhere between 6 minutes to 15 minutes long, and every week they explore some other strange oddity. This week, he's thrown us back to a Halloween episode he did with a really creepy story where Jeff and Ray Auger explore the woods around Camp Kurana in Cumberland, Rhode Island, in search of Fingernail Freddy and Hotshot Charlie, two reclusive Min monsters who are said to stalk the children of the summer camp should they get out of line. So without further ado, this week's Theater of the Mind takes you in a little bit of a different turn. Please turn down the lights, turn up the radio, and enjoy this New England Legends.
Oh, Jeff, there's nothing like a nice campfire on a dark night to get your imagination running.
I agree, Ray, and placing our campfire here in the woods of Cumberland, Rhode Island, just off of Diamond Hill Road, is the perfect place to spin an old yarn that's been going around these parts for more than half a century.
Oh, man, tell me there's some monster in these woods.
He is kind of like a monster. These woods are home to a man they call Fingernail Freddy. Jeff Belanger.
And I'm Ray Osier, and welcome to the New England Legends Podcast. Okay, Fingernail Freddy? That sounds familiar. Now, I'm a child of the 80s, so I'm crying foul and saying this sounds more like Freddy Krueger from Nightmare on Elm Street.
How sweet. Fresh meat.
Ray, I too am a child of the 80s and appreciate the cultural significance of Freddy Krueger and Wes Craven's horror masterpiece series as much as the next guy wearing, you know, parachute pants and sporting a mullet. But allow me to cry foul back on this one.
All right, how so?
Because Nightmare on Elm Street came out November 16th, 1984. And Fingernail Freddy of Cumberland, Rhode Island, he dates back at least to the 1950s.
Now, are you suggesting Wes Craven may have lifted this one?
Not exactly.
All right, let's set this up.
First, I want to thank my friend and folklorist, Dr. Michael Bell, author of Food for the Dead, it's a book about vampires in early New England, for this lead. I first heard about it on his website. The story starts at Camp Kurana in Cumberland. This camp was founded in 1937, right near the Diamond Hill Reservoir. It's a Catholic overnight summer camp, and many children over the years have gone through there, and lots of them were told the story of Fingernail Freddy.
All right, hold on. Let me get a marshmallow going on this fire to make some s'mores, and you could tell me the story of Fingernail Freddy.
Well, Fingernail Freddy is a recluse. He lives out in these woods because he doesn't want to be around people. He despises people, especially children.
So a summer camp full of kids right in his backyard wouldn't have made him happy at all.
No, he didn't like this camp one bit. They say he grew his fingernails out until they were like long razor claws. Camp counselors would sit around campfires, just like this one, and tell the kids they better be quiet at night or Fingernail Freddy was coming for them.
All right, wait a minute. I'm sensing these counselors use the story of Fingernail Freddy to scare the kids into keeping quiet, right?
I'm sure that's a huge part of the reason they told this story. They wanted to keep the kids quiet at night. But there's another version of a dangerous hermit in these very same woods, also told at Camp Karana. And they call this guy Hotshot Charlie.
Hotshot Charlie? All right, let me load up another marshmallow.
Hotshot Charlie is an old homesteader who was said to live in a log cabin in this forest. He had a barn, a small farm, and lived here with his wife and children. He was pretty self-sufficient, so he kept to himself, but that doesn't mean kids didn't come by to mess with him.
But what did they do?
They'd open the animal pens, they'd let his cows out, they'd steal his crops or knock them over, and just generally vandalize his property. Until one day, Charlie had had enough.
What did he do?
They say Hotshot Charlie grew so tired of the vandalism that he took to loading his shotgun with rock salt. If he caught you trespassing, he'd unload his shotgun on you. The rock salt would pierce your skin and offer a salty burn.
Ow! Well, it seems I've heard this story about some pissed off farmer with a rock salt shooting shotgun before.
I'm sure you have. I've heard it as well.
All right, let's look into this part of the story a bit more, because the rock salt shooting farmer is so prevalent.
Okay, what did you find?
Well, first, we know the idea of shooting rock salt from a shotgun goes back at least to the 1950s, and likely a few decades earlier than that.
What happened in the 1950s?
All right, there was a television series on ABC called The Rifleman, which first aired in 1958. It was a Western series that followed an old West rifleman named Lucas McCain, who was played by Chuck Connors, one of those 1950s actors with the jet black hair and the chin you could set your watch by. In one of those episodes, Lucas McCain loads his rifle with rock salt, because apparently he didn't want to kill the guys he was shooting at, but just, you know, sting them real good.
Those writers no doubt heard stories of their own back then about angry farmers and rock salt. But did anyone actually do it?
I'm sure they did. So, doing some more research, I came upon a blog on the Box O' Truth website, a website for gun enthusiasts, where the author, who goes by Old Painless, experimented with loading rock salt into shotgun shells to see their effect.
I love that. So what did he do?
Well, he took some empty shotgun shells, the kind you would load yourself, and filled them with rock salt. He set up a cardboard outline of a torso 20 yards away, aimed his shotgun, and Old Painless showed photographs of the cardboard that only had minor dents in a couple of places from the rock salt impact. So as he wrote, there's no way it would break the skin if that were a person. But he did say the report from the firing was as loud as normal. However, the gun gave almost no recoil.
So if you were eating French fries or something, at that distance, he may have salted them for you.
Right, right. Now, if only the next shot had ketchup. But Old Painless repeated the experiment at 10 yards. But this time, he placed a towel around the cardboard to simulate clothing. On the second firing, he saw a few deeper dents in the cardboard. But still, he doubts it would be enough to break the skin. So he tried again from 12 feet. This time, there was some breakthrough in the cardboard. At 12 feet, he figures it would hurt.
Yeah, but 12 feet's pretty darn close, though.
It is. And to be thorough, he tried one last time from 4 feet.
Come on. At 4 feet, you're better off just swinging the thing like a club.
At 4 feet, there was a pretty substantial hole in the cardboard. As Old Painless pointed out, it might not kill you, but we're talking a wound now.
It seems to me if I'm 20 or 30 yards from a person who's angry at me for trespassing, then I hear a shotgun go off, then feel the spray of something hitting me. Even if that spray doesn't hurt, it's crystal clear someone on the other end of that gun means business, and I'd guess I'm going to hightail it out of there as fast as I can.
It would serve the purpose of scaring for sure. Is that what Hotshot Charlie was trying to do here in Cumberland?
That's what he was trying to do at first, but this legend turns dark.
Oh, what happened?
The story goes that the kids were getting tired of getting hit with burning rock salt, so they decided to get even. One day when Charlie was out in the barn, some kids approached his cabin and set it on fire. Charlie saw the smoke and flames and ran into the cabin to save his wife and children, but he was too late. In trying to rescue his family, Charlie was severely burned, and his face became permanently disfigured. He was so grotesque, he stopped going into town altogether and became a recluse living in these woods. If any kids came looking for him, Hotshot Charlie would murder them. They'd never be seen again.
All right, this legend sounds like it was used by counselors to keep the kids from wandering off the camp property where they weren't supposed to.
I'm sure this legend served that purpose as well. But one former camper claims you can still see an old cellar hole just north of the camp, lending some physical evidence to this mystery person and legend.
All right, so we got one guy horribly burned in an unjust criminal act, another with long, razor-like fingers. Combine them both. Jeff, it sounds like Wes Craven's Freddy Krueger.
It does, but Wes Craven cites a different legend as the inspiration for his Nightmare on Elm Street villain. Back in the 1970s, otherwise young, healthy Asian men from Laos were seeking refuge in the United States, and some were dying in their sleep for unknown reasons. The medical community had no explanation, but they found enough cases to give it a name, or rather two names. The first was Asian Death Syndrome. The other was Sudden Unexpected Nocturnal Death Syndrome, or SUNS.
What was happening to these folks who were dying?
Well, as the medical community started looking at the numbers, they found 20 men, all from the Hmong community in Laos, were victims of this unexplained nocturnal death. They were relatively young, in good or excellent health, and died in their sleep. The doctors were baffled, but the Hmong folklore had an answer.
Now, we learned in a previous episode when we discussed a vampire in Vermont that folklore often gives us an answer. Now, what was Hmong's answer?
In the old country, they believed a creature called the Da Cho came to you in your dreams and attacked you. The way to keep him at bay was to make offerings to the spirits of your ancestors who would fight off the Da Cho for you. When the Hmong people came to America, they wanted to assimilate into American culture, so many of them stopped their old practices and offerings. Believers blame the Da Cho for these nocturnal deaths.
So Wes Craven hears about this story, a creature that kills you in your dreams, maybe mixes in a few other elements from stories and legends he's heard, and we get the horror movie icon, Freddy Krueger.
Freddy Krueger scares us because so many parts of his character sound familiar, like a song you've heard before. If you were a camper at Camp Corana in Cumberland, Rhode Island, Fingernail Freddy and Hotshot Charlie soaked into your DNA. So when you see even the slightest reminder of those nightmarish figures, you're suddenly a child again, sitting by the campfire and terrified of what monsters are lurking in those dark woods behind you.
All right, I think it might be time to put this campfire out and go home.
You can listen to this and all our past episodes for free on our website at OurNewEnglandLegends.com. We always post pictures and further links. And to see links to the old Painless Rock Salt Shotgun blog, just click on this episode, number 22, to find it.
And you can also subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Do us a favor and post a review. We appreciate you spreading the word about what we do.
Until next time, remember, the bizarre is closer than you think.
Beyond the darkness,
welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. I hope you enjoyed today's Theater of the Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to New England Legends by going to OurNewEnglandLegends.com, and you can subscribe there and never miss another episode. You can also find it on iTunes. But if you've got the Darkness Radio app for your Google player, whether it's your any Google device you have, just go to the Play Store and get the Darkness Radio app. And here's why you need it. Because not only can you hear our show and get a link to True Crime Tuesday, you can also find Legends, and I'm on the Tom Bernard Show in Minneapolis-St. Paul every Tuesday, and soon we'll be launching on Mondays on the Tom Bernard Show, a true crime aspect of his show. Every Monday, we'll be doing Murder Mondays in the third hour of the show, where we will investigate strange crimes over a 10 to 12 week period every last hour of the show, we will explore different angles. And for those of you that are subscribed to our True Crime Tuesday podcast and heard the tip of the iceberg of the weepy voice killer, we're going to be going so deep into the story over the Tom Bernard Show. You're going to have to check it out. So make sure you go get the Darkness Radio app through the Google Play Store. For those of you that do not have a Google device, you've got an iPhone, you can just go get the Tom Bernard podcast tool for yourself there. You can subscribe to it through there at the Apple Store. And remember to get the New England Legends podcast through there. And do me a favor, once you subscribe to New England Legends, go rate and review them. They are fantastic, and they definitely need more people to know about the show. Share it with your friends. Share it with your neighbors. Share it with your enemies. Share it with everybody. Let's bring the world together and help out a great podcast. Again, it comes out once a week, every Thursday. So check that out for yourself. Now, for those of you that are looking to get off your butts and get into the game, you want to go out and you want to see the paranormal firsthand, you can join me. I'm going to be visiting all kinds of great places throughout the United States this year. Everything from the Michigan Paracon to we're going to be at the Shooting Star Casino up in Menomon, Minnesota. I'll be there with a lot of the paranormal celebrities. I'll be the MC for the weekend, so you can come on out and hang out for that. I'm also going to Romania this year. We're going to be following in the footsteps of Dracula. That's right. You can join us as we go to Romania and get a chance to see four of the castles associated with Vlad the Impaler, following his historic footprints, and find out, is he more demon or angel to the people of Romania? You might be surprised. Plus, we get to investigate. You heard me right. Investigate two of those castles with our group. Plus, we kick off at the Baisu Forest, the haunted Baisu Forest. Not only is it known for its crazy paranormal activity, but cryptid encounters and UFO encounters. You don't believe me? Research it for yourself. But we are going to have an amazing time, and this, I think, will be my final trip to Romania. We have so many other countries to see around the world that we want to get out there and check it out. So this may be your last time to go with your buddy Dave from Darkness Radio to Romania. You can find information on this trip and all the trips we're going to be a part of simply by visiting darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. Don't wait. Tickets are going fast, especially for the Romania encounter. We'd love to have you join us. All right, we're back. The Dark Zone is excited to announce our latest contributor, Jason Higgs. His team's new show, Encounters, airing on Footprint.tv. It began back on Monday, March 19th. Two episodes are out and available right now. You can check that out again by visiting Footprint.tv. It's part of the Dark Zone Network that I'm a proud member of. So you can go check that out. And it's great to have you join us, Jason, to get a chance to hear from you, hear about your experiences, and promote your amazing show. So thank you again for being here.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, it's great to be on.
I want to know, you've got all of these great team members. Now, they don't go into the investigation with you, per se. You get a chance to go into these places alone. But do you use Kevin Hines, the psychic medium, to kind of, does Kevin kind of work as a dowsing rod for you? Does he say, hey, you might want to check this area. I'm sensing something in this area for you to investigate. Or does he come in after the investigation for you? How do you work with him if he's not on site?
Yeah, basically he acts almost like, as you say, a dowsing rod for me. So Kevin will go in and do his own little experience, if you like, around what the location, wherever it is. And then he'll sort of come out and say, do you know what? I'm picking up this in this area. You might want to look at it more. And I'm picking up this in this area. You might want to focus some tech there. And then we sort of take his experiences, and it, in the day leading up to the investigation is when we do all the sort of the presentations, the witness interviews, and all of the sort of B-roll cutaways, that kind of thing. So we do get, as a whole team, a sense of the location before I go in the evening and perform the investigation. So with the information I'm armed with from Kevin and from the witness reports, and also there's usually an expert that we talk to who knows the location like the back of their hand, I usually take that information then, and that's how we divvy up the location into bite-sized chunks to make sure that we cover all our bases. And so in each area, I'll tend to use different equipment that, you know, Kevin and the witnesses have said probably would work. But then if the evening is going in a certain direction where I'm not getting a lot, then it's sort of, I'll throw open the tech and I'll throw open the questions and I'll throw up open the investigation techniques to see what else I can sort of get from the evening and hopefully get from the location.
What, in your opinion, of all the locations you've visited, what would you say is probably one of the most paranormally active locations you've ever been to?
Yes. Okay. So probably for me, and we've never filmed encounters there yet, is a place in Wales called Craganos Castle. And unfortunately, by its name, you think, oh, great sort of castle-like structure. And it is. It's a beautiful place. But it's a hotel now. But there's one level that they've kept exactly as it was back in the early 1900s. Now, the castle obviously has got a lengthy history, but the part of it which is really interesting, it was bought by a lady. Oh, I'm trying to think of her name now. Adelina Patti, her name was, and she was an opera singer back in the early 1900s. And she opened up on site a theatre. There's a theatre actually there, and it's still there to this day. Open chairs, there's a stage and a piano. And she opened up the sort of the upstairs area, and that was used for children with TB. So there was lots of beds and a lot of children came and actually died there, because it was at the time when they believed putting the children outside in the cold air would cure them of the TB. And so a lot of children actually died there. But the upstairs area is exactly the same as it was left from the, all those years ago. So it's a weird location. You walk in, there's a modern hotel reception where you can check in. And then someone says, right, oh, you're with the paranormal group, come this way. And you walk through a door, you walk up a sort of a modern staircase, and then there's this like sealed off door that they take you through. And then that's where the modern era stops. And this extra area, if you like, another staircase that's almost like a dilapidated wooden staircase from 1910. And you get guided up this staircase, and upstairs it's all the same, as I say. There's just wooden floorboards. There's patient notes still hanging on the wall. There's old, almost like military style beds with teddy bears on them and things like this. And obviously, this is an area that's been investigated a lot. You know, they've got their own cameras there permanently set up to record anything, and there's a lot of groups that come and go. But for me, it's actually the only other time I've ever seen what I would class as a manifestation. And I was in this room with one other guy who was filming, and at the end of this room was a window, and there was sort of a bit of moonlight shining through this window, so you could see sort of shadows cast on the wall and a bit of shadow on the floor. And all of a sudden I looked over to the window and I could see and again it was a black shadow standing in front of the window. And I think in my eyes were, you know, still adjusting to the light in the room, I moved my head from side to side just to see if the shadow would dissipate, but it didn't. It stayed almost in a solid form. And as I moved my head, it stayed exactly where it was, floating just in front of the window. So I thought, well, this is a bit strange. And I said to the guy, I said, what could you see on the camera? And he said, well, there's just lots of what looks like orbs or dust potentially shooting up and down. So I said, okay. So I walked over to the black mass. And as I walked towards it, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. So as I was approaching it, it, you know, as you would expect as you walk towards a physical being, that person, you know, sort of looked like it was getting closer. So I thought, okay, I'm going to put my arms around this black mass. So I put my arms around and I joined my hands behind it. And my hands, I could hardly see my hands. I could just make them out. There was sort of an 80% opaqueness with regards to the black mass. And I said to the guy again, I said, what can you see now on the camera? And he says, I can see you and I can see your hands, but it looks like there's all these orbs just shooting up and down between your arms. Nowhere else in the room, just there. And I had all this tingling sensation in my arms where it was just touching this black mass. And then it started to move. and it was moving to my right. And as it was moving, I moved my arms with it. And I called to the guy again. I said, what's this look like? What does it look like? And he said, it looks like the orbs are moving to the right. He said that they're just firing up and down. These balls of light are firing up and down between your arms. And with that, sort of all within the space of probably about 20 seconds, it started to dissipate. And then it was gone. My arm stopped tingling. And I called to the guy again and said, oh, you know, what can you see now? He goes, well, nothing. It's all gone. So what he was getting on video was vastly different to what I could see, but there was a correlation between my experience and what he was filming. And it was an absolutely bizarre experience. I can't really explain it, but and to this day, I don't know what that was, but I was excited and also scared at the same time about what it was. But the tingling sensation in my arms really sort of said to me that I'm definitely in contact with something here. Very, very strange experience. And that's just one of about three or four different experiences at two different times that we'd investigated this location. And both times I've ended up leaving earlier than I wanted to because of personal experiences.
All right. So you have this. But first of all, why haven't you filmed an episode of Encounters there yet?
Cost, unfortunately. It costs a lot of money to hire out. And for that type of sort of building, we'd need to hire it for probably 3 or 4 days. So at the moment, we just haven't got the finance to put into filming there. But definitely, once we get some money together, that's definitely the next location.
What are you talking about, Jason? Everybody knows people in the paranormal make millions of dollars doing investigations and filming it. How?
Yeah, I'd like to keep that in the back.
All right, so that was one of the locations. Now, in the first two episodes, why don't you talk to us a little bit about each one of the episodes that are up and available right now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly the first episodes that are up there, Margam Castle, very, very cracking location. Again, this is a big old Gothic castle in Wales, funny enough, near to where I used to live. It's an absolutely beautiful location. I would recommend it to anyone to go and have a look. You can walk around it in the day and have a look around. Beautiful grounds as well, you know, it's surrounded. And it's got a lot of history, as you'll see in the episodes as they come out. But again, it was a great location, a lot of history, as I say, and also the experiences of lots of witnesses that had gone there before. And it's in a location that I'd investigated a number of years ago, and we had such a great time then and picked up so much stuff that we thought, well, it's almost a guarantee if we come back, we should hopefully be able to get something. And again, we hired it for a couple of days and basically filmed there over a number of days and a number of evenings. In fact, it was a very tiring investigation, because at one day we literally filmed for 36 hours straight. We had about probably 20 minutes sleep in that time. There was a lot of Red Bull and coffee going on, as you can imagine, which may have skewed some of the personal experiences I had.
That was going to say, you know, there's a lot of studies now that are being done that caffeine can actually cause hallucinations. So I've tried to stray away from caffeine and those kind of shots and drinks now from doing that. Were you aware that kind of effect could be, you could have that kind of effect kicked up on caffeine?
Yeah, I mean, because I've drunk coffee a lot, basically, ever since I was young. But again, talking about the personal experiences, really, it was more about what we captured there. I did have my own personal experiences there, certainly. But as I say, sort of from a visual perspective, I've only really ever had two experiences, and that was that one as a child, and obviously that one with the Black Mass at Kragernos Castle. So with hallucinations, that never really bothered me, because visually, I seem to be lacking in that area when it comes to experiences.
Now, it's interesting that you say you've only had two personal experiences, yet you get back and review the video and audio, and you find that you've had others. Does it have to be something that personally affects you, like being touched or seeing something, for you to say that, you know, that you had an experience? Or, you know, do you count the EVP and the video equipment and things that you've recorded as a personal experience as well?
Well, when I say only two, I mean two visual experiences. Okay. So I've only seen two. I've had many personal experiences. Usually there's a number of them every time we investigate. So when I talk about two experiences, I'm only literally talking about two. I've only seen two things that I can't explain. I've certainly been touched many a time, smelt, which is ironic. My smell senses are quite strong. Can usually, for instance, another location was Woodchester Mansion. And there was a strong smell of TCP, and it turns out that that area had been used for medical reasons in the World War II, I think, where they tended to the soldiers. So definitely personal experiences with smell, with touch, with taste, hearing, definitely. But it's just visually, I think. I've only ever had the two experiences. But certainly Markham Castle is a great location for those type of experiences. And we've captured stuff on audio and video. There was a lot of, how can you explain it, teasing going on. So you'd be in one room, hear a noise in another. You progress to that room, then there's a noise back in the room you just left. But luckily we had recorders running. I think some of the great footage, I don't really want to, you know, spoil the show that's coming up, but we definitely had some great footage captured at that location, which will be evident in the episodes as they come out.
All right, now what? Now the episode you just described, was that the first episode out or the second episode?
It'll be further on, probably third or fourth. Some of the stuff we've captured.
Oh, great! All right, and when you're doing this and you're setting these locations up, you're looking into this. If they make claims of demonic presence or dark malevolent forces, is there anything you do prior to doing an investigation that you would do differently just going in for a regular run-of-the-mill ghost haunting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kev, our psychic medium, that's his role really as well. So he'll almost canvas the location to make sure that it's safe, you know, with regards to demonics or the unknown entities, as you like, that could be there. The ones who claim that they're male and female, but actually they're neither. They're just an entity. And he'll go in and basically he'll say to me, look, Jason, I think you need to be careful in this room. Do you want me to put protection in place? And then I'll say, yeah, probably a good idea. Let's do that. Or let's leave it for a minute. And maybe if something bad happens, we'll get you in to protect it then after.
If something bad happens, we'll come back and clean you up a little later, Jason. So is this first season going to all just be at Markham Castle then?
Certainly, the first five episodes are all at Markham, and then with that, but there's lots more episodes to come, different locations. We've got Bodmin Jail, which is an absolutely cracking location, one of my favorite locations.
Why is that?
And it's literally,
what about it makes it such a favorite place?
It's just it's an old jail going back to the 1700s. It's one of the first sizes jails in Cornwall. Probably the main one, I would say, in Cornwall. But there was just so much desolation there. People were hung quite regularly there for minor crimes, such as stealing apples, for example. Children were held there. The conditions weren't great. There was a naval wing there, so there was a lot of military that was actually based. Was held there, if you like, in and out of Bodmin Jail. But also the whole history of the place ever since it closed as a jail. This was an interesting bit of tidbit that I found out literally in January, that it had been a casino and that it had been a nightclub. And that there's a company that actually came in and tried to demolish it. They set all these charges down to blow it up and basically use the land and basically the old granite to rebuild something else. And every time they set off the charges, it wouldn't blow up. It wouldn't. It just some floors went, but the walls wouldn't fall down. In World War II, the Luftwaffe flew over and tried to destroy Bodmin Jail, failed. You know, none of their bombs hit, and it's still standing there today. It just refuses to die. And the experiences you get at Bodmin are amazing. Every time you go into the old structure, it's a big old granite structure. You know, you talk about stone tape theory, and a lot of groups have been there and done investigations. The public walk around it every day, but it's just the whole experience of Bodmin Jail, it just fails to not deliver. It's just an amazing place.
Has there ever been an investigation that you've gotten into that you start to think, man, maybe I'm in over my head in this one. There might be something here I shouldn't be messing with.
Absolutely. You're talking about Kraganos Castle, and on the two occasions that I've investigated, we've had to leave early twice. And the main reason was my personal experience. And I talked about Adelina Patti in a theater. Mm-hmm. Well, we did Singapore Theory, so we had a tape recorder rigged up with some of her old music. And we all went into the theater, five of us, and I sat in a chair near the front. And we said, right, let's start the Singapore Theory. So we just literally got in. 5 minutes into the investigation, I sit two rows from the front, and I press play on the tape recorder, sat down, and just let the music wash over me. So I just, you know, closed my eyes, got into the zone, imagining Adelina Patti on stage singing, someone playing the piano, and I can imagine the chairs being filled with people in tuxedos, you know, with nice bow ties. At the start, you know, mumbling to themselves, and then as the music started, you know, this silence covering the theatre. And I just imagine her singing, and she was going through the song, and it was beautiful. I could see her standing there in a ball gown, you know, just really got myself into that moment. And as the song finished, I could imagine all the applause that followed that from the theatre. And then a sort of a, you know, the talking amongst people. And with that, one of my colleagues tapped me on the shoulder and said, that's session over, mate. We need to go. And I said, what are you on about? We've only been here 5 minutes. He goes, no, we've been here an hour. Hmm. And I had zoned out for an hour. Now, what was equally frightening was I only remember 5 minutes of the entire session. And that's that 5 minutes where I was listening to the music. And they've got footage where they've filmed the location for the last, you know, sort of the following 55 minutes. And that they, as they sort of panning around and filming and doing different things, they've sort of panned the camera across me and my eyes are wide open, not closed. And they've also apparently come up to me and said, Jason, you were right. Shone a torch in my eye and my pupils didn't dilate. So what happened to me personally, I still to this day don't know, but I lost 55 minutes of my life in that theater. And when I came out, when they sort of woke me up and I came around, I had no emotion. I had no emotion. I had no sort of expression. And I felt just, I didn't feel myself. And I said to, sort of, we stayed another 20 minutes or so. And I said, look, I've got to go because I don't feel right. And I was willing, in my mind, to have an experience or do things that normally I would have taken more of a step back from. So I said, I need to leave this location and get away. And it wasn't until I was sort of 25, 30 miles away from that location that I started to feel myself again. A very strange experience.
What do you make of that? Do you think that in a sense you became one with your surroundings? You became one in a place of time and space?
I honestly don't know. I've thought about it so many times since, and it's only ever happened once since then, which was at Coalhouse Fort in Essex, which is a big old fort. And I don't understand the feeling, basically. When I was at Coalhouse Fort, we had an experience in one room. Again, it was Singapore Theory that we performed, but there was this black mass apparently stood right in front of me. Someone saw from across the room, and the guide there said, right, we need to get out right now. Sort of, I wanted to stay. So everyone's panicking. Everyone's sort of like, we need to get out of here. But I felt comfortable in this one particular room that everyone else had felt really uncomfortable in. And I wanted to stay. And then when we got outside, I had this feeling of, I want to go back in. I want to go back into that room. And it was the same sort of feeling of no fear, you know, that sort of calmness. I feel comfortable in that environment. I want to go back in. And that's the same feeling that I had when I was at Kraganos Castle, which was worrying, you know, it's a sort of an unnatural feeling. But I can't explain it. I really honestly can't explain what it is or why I felt it. Did I become one with the environment? Maybe. Did I get taken over by something? I don't know. But it wasn't until 20 minutes after the location that I start to come around and feel, and I had a headache. It was like a hangover. It was a very strange experience. 20 minutes later, I felt like I was aching all over and I had a headache. So I really, did I have a medical condition? I don't know, but as I say, only twice it has ever happened to me in all the years that I've been doing this.
I'll just throw an interesting aspect of this to you. You know, it might be interesting to have a hypnotic regression done, like a past life regression. Maybe you came into contact with a location that you had been to before, and you resonated, you connected with that location because you have been there, and that has been part of your story.
I mean, that makes sense. I've always wondered about past life regression. So that's definitely definitely an answer.
It's just, again, thinking outside the box, but it's just, you know, to me, that seems like maybe there's something to that because, you know, for you to connect with that place and really no other place like that before or since, it makes you wonder, you know, why did you immerse into that moment? If we're resonating at that same vibrational kind of key in lock moment, that might be something to do with it. It's something fascinating to consider at least. That's
absolutely
what's so great about this field, right? There's a lot of conjecture, a lot of theory and thought, but it's something that might be worth investigating a little further to see if we can make connections to why we have profound experiences at some places and not so much at others.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It
definitely needs more thought.
I had been on the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California, and was in the ballroom where we had held our event all weekend long that was bustling with 200 to 300 people in and out and in and out. And I was there with the lady I was seeing at the time, and all the lights were out, and I was feeling kind of down because this was going to be my last event at the Queen Mary Hotel. And we were just kind of cuddled up there and exchanging kisses and things. And all of a sudden, both of our heads turned at the same time. We both began seeing shadow people move around in this room. And I had this distinct feeling that we were kind of reliving almost the night before, watching people get up and leave, because I looked at the clock. It was around the same time we had excused everybody the night before. The night before had gone longer. And I realized, I wonder if we are watching a replay of last night's ending, because it was so active suddenly. And we were in this kind of, you know, euphoric moment while you're kissing and sharing this emotional moment, and your brain's kicking out that kind of chemical of pleasure and awe. And I'm just wondering if that had some effect to why we were suddenly able to see, because it was something we both saw, we both experienced, and it lasted for a long time. So it was almost like you were put into that place. You could hear almost the applause, the crowd, you were like part of that moment again in time and space.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think there's so many areas to this that I think needs further research, and it's just a shame there isn't more money to pump into this type of thing. You know, we talk about making TV shows and the such to get this information out there to people, but, you know, I always imagined that if I ever became a millionaire that I would donate some money towards research in this field. You know, there's so much research that needs doing to try and explain these experiences.
Well, pick me, Jason. Pick me to send that money to, because I'll definitely I'll investigate.
And vice versa, Dave.
Sure. Very cool. I know we don't have a whole lot of time left together. I know you've written a couple of books, and talk to me about the books and a couple of your favorite stories from each one.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first book that we wrote, it was me and a colleague called Stuart Andrews, is called Paranormal Cornwall. And it was commissioned by the History Press, which is a publisher in the UK. And they basically wanted, you know, a book about the history and the sort of paranormal stories, if you like, of Cornwall. So that's what we put together. We split the book, and I researched and wrote my side, if you like, and then Stuart did his side. And there's some cracking stories in there, the usual sort of old folk tales of pixies on the moor and the legend of Merlin with regards to one of the lakes that's close to us. And then there's various pubs. Pubs are always great in the UK. there seems to be quite a strong feeling that, you know, sort of certainly from a gentleman's perspective, that as you get older, you tend to, you know, if you've lost a loved one, then the next place you tend to hang out more is your local pub, you know, so you can still socialize and see characters that you know. And then obviously you pass on. So where would you go back? I'd go back to the local pub. And certainly these pubs that we have in England are, you know, they go, some of them date back centuries. So they're pretty old pubs with old beams. And then it's usually we get called in because a new occupier has gone into that pub. They've started to renovate and things start kicking off. And it's, you know, we always have the joke that, well, they don't like change. They like it the way it is. It's always been that way. You've come in, you've ripped that bar out, and you've put the shelving in, and that's when glasses get pushed off bars and lights are on and off, and, you know, various other activity takes place. So we get called into a lot of pubs, and it's usually as a new occupier has taken over. And so we talk about a number of pubs in paranormal Cornwall. And then a follow-up to that, my colleague Kev Hines, who's our psychic medium, has written a couple of books. He wrote Haunted Plymouth and then also Haunted Dartmoor, and I wrote Haunted Bodmin Moor. So he's written about Devon. I've written about Cornwall, if you like. And the book, The Moor, is a cracking place. You know, where I live in Cornwall, I'm sort of 10 minutes away from the sea. I'm 10 minutes away from moorland and literally 20 minutes away from the nearest city. So I can experience, you know, I could go down to the beach, or I can go high up onto the moor. And the moor itself has got so much history, the old monolithic structures, the tors, there's caves up there. And obviously the moor is littered with old pubs such as Jamaica Inn, you know, fantastic old place that's been written about by Daphne du Maurier. Bodmin Jail is on the moor. And obviously when you talk about, you know, granite structures, and you talk about ley lines, you can imagine there's a lot of history. And there's been probably thousands of people who've perished on the you know, the desolate moors due to weather, due to natural experiences, due to falling off rocks, you know, falling into a marsh. So there's a lot of history there, you know, the story of the White Lady. It makes for a cracking read. And the majority of the book is made up of history, witness reports again, and then also, if we've done an investigation there, what do we uncover? And there's lots of pictures as well. So it makes for a nice, friendly storytelling time.
And we've included links to that. Again, if you go to darknessradio.com, click on the Killer Deals link, you'll be taken right to our Amazon page where we put together all of the great books that you hear featured on the show, whether they're books, DVDs, documentaries, or all the cool paranormal swag we've put together for you. Go check it out for yourself right now. You're going to love it. And remember, every time you make a purchase from that, a small, very small percentage goes to help your pals here on Beyond the Darkness with our administrative costs and streaming costs to keep the show free for you and make it available. So make sure you check that out and continue to support all of the great guests that you hear on the show. And do us a favor, too. If you buy the books and you read the books, rate and review the books. And remember, give them all 5 stars and big thumbs up, because these guys and gals that are writing these books, they rely on your feedback to continue to get more book sales and more book deals so that we can continue to share more and more of the strange and supernatural. Encounters, again, is a brand new paranormal show which uses latest cutting-edge technology in the paranormal field and sees our seasoned investigator and Haunted Plymouth team member Jason Higgs experience alleged haunted locations around the country, and he does it alone. You can check that out now on Footprint.tv. It's part of the Dark Zone, and we're very proud to have him be a part of the Dark Zone. You can get more information about that. And remember, if you have the Darkness Radio app for your phone, for Google devices, there's also a link to the Dark Zone there, so you can find more information and keep up with it. Jason, in heading out, for people that are interested and maybe on the fence of, wow, do I need another paranormal show? In kind of the world that we live in right now, and there's been a lot of shows that have come and gone, what do you think sets your show apart from the others?
Sure, that's a good question, Dave. I think for us in the UK, there's only ever really been one other show, and that's Most Haunted, which has obviously been running for years and years. And it's the same format, obviously, as the standard other shows. In America, paranormal is a massive thing, and you have so many shows there, and they're all great shows, you know, and they all have their own angle take on it. But when we put together this show, we wanted to take sort of all the experiences that I had, Kev had had over the years, and then bring together a good production team to then make something a bit more different. So that's why we did the, okay, I'm going to be locked in alone 12 or 24 hours, depending on how long it takes to investigate. So you've got the fear factor. You know, people are worrying. This guy's in there alone. And when you see Markham Castle, you see how big that structure is. So to think of me in there with multiple rooms, multiple levels, pitch black, on my own all night, you start to think, God, you know, is this guy sane? And when you're in there, you know, don't get me wrong, I've been doing this for, you know, over 20 years, but any new location I go into, I'm always apprehensive. And when I've already had experiences like I had at Markham while we were filming, and then to be locked in alone, I was honestly slightly cacking my pants. And some of the experiences I had in there, you know. Right. So we've got the fear side of things. And then the second side is the more scientific reason is the contamination. Now, with the likes of Most Haunted, they go in, they've got their presenter and their psychic. And then there's probably about five or six people following them around with cameras, boom mics, you know, producers and all the rest. We didn't want that because that kind of entourage is going to create contamination, floorboards, walls. And we know this from the many investigations we do with the public. It's never really a proper investigation because you don't know if any one of those other people who's in the room with you, their stomach might go, they might whisper something, they might click an ankle, they might step on something, push something. You just can't trust any sort of evidence that you gather when there's anyone else in the room. So for me, when I'm there, I know exactly what I'm doing, what I'm saying, how I'm feeling. And therefore, when I review the footage, I know, yeah, that was me. I can discount that. Wait a minute. I don't understand what that is. And I have to say, with the Markham episode, we've, as I say, captured some cracking evidence. And one of the tools we use is one of the Ghost Hunter apps, Ghost Box, if you like, in Ovilus. And we have literally got the Ghost Hunter app saying the name of the person who built Markham Castle. And that's coming up on a later episode. It's a little teaser for you, if you like. But I didn't know at the time who had built Markham Castle. I just threw the question out there in one of my sessions, and the answer comes back clear as day through the Ghost Hunter app. And I didn't know this until I got home, reviewed it. I said, who built Markham Castle? And to my surprise, it's the name that comes out of the app. And it's not just as if it said, this person built Markham Castle and gave the name. It just throws it out there as if you were having a conversation like you and me. So it just went, blah, blah, he built it. Just like that. Blah, blah, he built it. And it was absolutely amazing. And at the time, I didn't know. Googled it. Yeah, can't believe it. It's 100% correct. So for me, again, Markham Castle, great structure. And we've got plenty more locations and amazing evidence coming up on the show. And there's one location, a special sort of episode that we'll be releasing later on, which is about Satanism. So it's more of a documentary looking at the way Satanism works and sort of the whole ritual aspect of this game. And there's one location I investigate, an underground fort, and we have some drastic camera movement. No one else is in this fort, just me, and the camera moves quite drastically, so that's something to look out for.
Very cool. We look forward to seeing that. All right, Jason, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to the new episodes of Encounters as they come out, and please, as new parts of the series break, will you come back and visit with us?
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for having us on, Dave.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you very much, and thank you all for tuning in and making us part of your world. Remember, we'll be back again with you next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio and the best in true crime talk radio. That's right, True Crime Tuesday. You can check us out now every Tuesday, brand new episodes of the best in true crime as we talk strange and bizarre stories of true crime. And we also take a look at dumb crime, stupid criminals. I knew a murderer. That's right. If you knew a murderer, if you were friends, relatives, or went to school with a murderer, we want you to email us your story at dave@darknessradio.com. Tell me about that experience. Were you a survivor of a serial killer? Did you know a killer and only found out about it later? We want to hear your story. Email me, dave@darknessradio.com. And you can subscribe to True Crime Tuesday by going to darknessradio.com and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. It's only $5 a month. It gives you access to every brand new episode and all of our archived episodes on the site. So you can check out the last year's worth of episodes, plus get every new episode as it releases on Tuesday, and you can listen to them anytime, anywhere. And it's not a long-time contract. You sign up for $5 a month. If you don't like it or decide it's not for you, you can cancel. And you can always re-sign up again later when it's convenient for you. So check it out, take advantage of it, and hear the best in True Crime Talk Radio. Go sign up at darknessradio.com. Click on that True Crime Tuesday banner. Until next week, be kind, be nice, and love one another. We'll talk to you again real soon right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait. You mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.